This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. It's The Damage Report. I'm Johnny Rolla. We've got a gigantic, jam-packed show that we will definitely not get to everything. So you're going to want to watch tomorrow's show, too, because I already know some of the content's going to be great. Through the course of this hour, we're going to be talking about Donald Trump's taking a few more steps towards authoritarianism in some behind-the-scenes conversations with people working at the border during his recent trip to California, as well as some truly inane conversation from his press secretary on why the Democrats should never see his tax returns. It's a dumb argument, and we're going to make fun of it in just a little bit. Later on throughout the hour, we've got two awesome guests. Towards the end, author Nancy Rosenblum is going to join us, who recently wrote a book about the new generation of conspiracy theorists, or I should say, people who believe conspiracies but have absolutely no theory about them. We're going to be talking about that book later on. And in just a little bit, we're going to have an organizer behind the Green New Deal who's going to be on to talk about that policy, AOC's vision around it, and how it is going to shape the Democratic primary. Also, meanwhile, in to close out the show, and an author online collected people's family accounts of what Fox News did to generally their parents. It's almost always the parents. Never like my nephew is suddenly a big Glenn Beck fan. But some awesome accounts of how people's brains were corroded by exposure to the Five coming up in just a little bit. But first, Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been a little bit restrained over the past couple of years in terms of his willingness to openly break the law. He has dabbled with it at times, and certainly he has no interest in traditions and norms and conventions and all of that. But when it comes to the strict letter of the law, generally he has been willing to go along with it. But we might be entering a phase of his presidency where he's not a fan of that anymore. And that reporting came about yesterday in conversations that he had with people working at the border. We're going to get to that in just a second. But first, his messaging in general about the border has become more xenophobic with every passing day. Last Friday, he was visiting California and he said, quote, "We're full. Our system's full. Our country's full. Can't come in. Our country is full. What can you do? We can't handle anymore. Our country is full. Can't come in. I'm sorry. It's very simple. I had to resist the urge to do 10 minutes breaking down all the way that's ridiculous. I will just quickly say that there are any number of major cities that have 500,000 or 1 million less people than they did back in 1950. We are less population dense than I believe 145 other countries, which is most of them actually. And so the reason I'm not going to go more in depth is because I don't think anybody actually believes that we're full and we can't take the people. It's just a way of dehumanizing them and saying that they don't have enough value for them to be considered a worthwhile addition to our country. So understand that that's what he's saying about immigrants and migrants recently, but let's move on with some of the scarier stuff. Behind the scenes, two sources told CNN the president told border agents to not let migrants in. Tell them we don't have the capacity, he said. If judges give you trouble, say, sorry, judge, I can't do it. We don't have the room. And so that's two different sources, two different fake news sources, since, of course, they come from CNN. I'm sure the president is going to attack them very soon. But what they're saying there is that he is telling border officers, people with the authority to detain or let pass various people, to pursue investigations or not, those who are going to be dealing with these migrants when they're being held in the barbaric conditions that we've seen. And he's telling them that if a judge gives you an order, don't follow what the judge says. The idea of checks and balances, I find it inconvenient. And so don't feel like you should be obligated to actually pursue that. And if you think, oh, that's Donald Trump being folksy or joking around, the border officers apparently didn't get the joke. After the president left the room, agents sought further advice from their leaders who told them they were not giving them that direction. And if they did what the president said, they would take on personal liability. You have to follow the law, they were told. I wish someone had told the president that, because he apparently doesn't think that he's required to anymore. And so you had people, like I don't know how many people were in the room, but they're working in California on the border. They're the ones who are responsible for putting into effect his immigration agenda. And he's telling them, do not feel bound by the law anymore. And of course, we know from the last week or so, especially since Kirstjen Nielsen stepped down as head of Department of Homeland Security, that he doesn't feel in general like he should be bound by the law anymore. That is what led to her being kicked out. She apparently kept telling him that, look, I am all in for your immigration agenda. I hate these people as much as you do. Let's cage them if we find them. But we do have to abide by the law. And he found that to be too constraining. And that led to multiple blowups behind the scenes. It led to a meeting whose express purpose was to patch over their differences and chart a path going forward on immigration for Kirstjen Nielsen and Donald Trump, instead to her tendering her resignation. Because once again, she apparently told him that I'm not going to break the law for you. And he will not abide that anymore. And by the way, it goes beyond Kirstjen Nielsen. She's obviously the highest profile departure of the past week or so, but more are planned. New York Times had a headline, Trump purge set to force out more top Homeland Security officials. Now, on any of these individual ones, like the director of the Secret Service, some of the undersecretaries of Homeland Security, I don't know enough about their personal politics or their history with Donald Trump to tell you exactly what they've clashed with him in terms of. But he apparently feels like those who have been instituting his agenda over the past couple of years are not sufficiently loyal, not sufficiently deferential to his personal will held aloft over not only traditions and norms, but also regulations and laws and court orders. And understand the context that we're talking about here. Just about 24 hours ago, a judge said that his statement that those who are pursuing coming in from Mexico and waiting for asylum have to wait in Mexico. They can't come in while pursuing asylum. The judge struck that down. And so that's another one of these things where the judiciary has thankfully saved us from the worst excesses of the Trump presidency. Will he feel bound by that? Is that actually what he was talking with the border agents about? I don't know. We don't have any more inside information about it. But in the future, we have been able, in the past, I should say, we've been able to count on the courts to save us just a little bit every once in a while. And he is specifically saying that judges should not be followed anymore. And if he thinks that a border officer can take it upon himself or herself unilaterally to not follow a court order, how bound by one do you think Donald Trump will be? And outside of immigration, if he is required, for instance, by law to hand in his tax returns, as we're going to talk about in a minute, if it goes to the Supreme Court, and if the Supreme Court says, oh, you actually have to do this, will he feel bound by that? Why would he at this point when he has set the precedent that he has already? And in terms of the stakes, we talked about this yesterday. I just want to remind you, Jake Tapper reports that Trump wants family separated, even if they appear at ports of entry requesting asylum. Quote, he just wants to separate families, said an unnamed senior administration official. So when he goes about flouting these court orders, when he tells the judges to go stuff it and then does what he wants is to separate families. And not just families that break the law by crossing the border. Those who follow exactly the letter of the law. They go to a port of entry. They formally apply for asylum. He wants to separate those families. Not because he has to. Not because he needs to. But because he wants to. And that is a scary precedent going forward as well. Okay, let's move on to the taxes, though. When Donald Trump sends his press people onto TV, he's not sending his best. That's what I get out of Kayleigh McEnany's recent appearance on Fox News. Here's what she had to say about the recent effort by congressional Democrats to get access to Donald Trump's taxes.
Here's the Wall Street Journal headline terror. Many unhappy Trump returns. Democrats think they can embarrass the president over his tax secrecy. So you heard over the weekend, the president's team says not going to happen. So will they continue on this fight?
Sure, they will, and they're going to lose because you have to have a legitimate legislative purpose when you request someone's returns. When asked what their purpose is, they say, well, we want to make sure that presidents are being audited correctly. Ironically, the only persons whose tax returns they've asked for, the only president is Trump. So it's a sham reasoning.
Okay, so that's ridiculous for a couple different reasons, and we're going to break them down. But first, before we get to what the spokesperson said, the host said, Democrats want the taxes. Trump says not going to happen. So are they going to persist in this? Like, think about how disinterested that host is with what the law is. He said he's not going to do it. Is it legal? Is it not legal to say that? Who cares at this point? Why are they going to persist with this when it's so annoying to Donald Trump? But let's turn to Kayleigh. She said, I think it's odd that he's the only president they're requesting taxes for. Well, I looked it up, and we have but one president to give at this point. There's only one, and yes, he is the only one that they're asking. But of course, it's more ridiculous than just that. The reason they have not had to do this, either Democrats or Republicans, by the way, going back literally decades, is that it was never necessary because, of course, they willingly furnished the tax returns anyway. And so, although what I'm about to engage in is totally ridiculous and shouldn't be necessary, just for the record, let's go through it. According to the Tax History Project, President Barack Obama released his tax returns for every year between 2000 and 2015. President George W. Bush released his returns for 2000 through 2007. Again, those times, by the way, are when they were president and even beyond for Barack Obama. President Bill Clinton made public his returns from 1992 to 1999, again, while he was president. Hillary Clinton released her tax returns for 16 years, and she never even became president. President George H.W. Bush releases taxes for 89, 90, and 2000. He missed a few years there. I don't even know why he released 2000. The dude hadn't been president for like a decade at that point, but he still did it. President Ronald Reagan released his taxes for 81, 82, 83, 85, 86, and 87. He missed a couple of years, but he was senile at that point, so I'm gonna let it slide. Presidents Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, and Richard Nixon also released their taxes as well. Kayleigh probably doesn't know that, and I'm sure if she learned it, she wouldn't care, but I think it's important for the people to know that this is not some new thing that came about once The Apprentice was no longer on the air. Presidents have always provided their taxes, going back as long as I have been alive. And the reason is that this might shock her and it might shock you, I don't know. Presidents have engaged in some pretty corrupt behavior in the past. Teapot Dome, look it up. We're going to talk about it later on this week, actually. But we want to make sure that presidents are not personally benefiting from their position of authority. And we want to make sure that they got into office without any sort of illegal behavior. And so, going back literally decades, regardless of whether they were left-wing, centrist, or right-wing, they have been more than willing to provide their tax information. But not so now. And they're willing to go against at least the spirit of the law, if not the letter of the law, just yet. Treasury Department lawyers consulted with the White House General Counsel's office about the potential release of Trump's tax returns. This is before this week's request for them. This is according to Stephen Mnuchin. The process is, by the way, designed to be walled off from White House interference, again, because of the Teapot Dome scandal of the 1920s, which we'll break down later this week. So they're not even supposed to be talking about this, but Mnuchin has already revealed that they have. And the entire thing, by the way, is a ridiculous joke. What I have had to reveal to you is a joke. Her appearance on Fox News is a joke. There is no ambiguity on this matter. The law as written, the Constitution as written, in general, in many cases, can provide a little bit of, we need to interpret things, maybe the Supreme Court needs to get involved. In this case, the law is shockingly clear about how this process is supposed to play out. It's so clear, I'm going to read the entire thing for you right now, and it's only going to take a few seconds. Upon written request from the chairman of the Committees on Ways and Means of the House of Representatives, the chairman of the Committee on Finance of the Senate, or the chairman of the Joint Committee on Taxation, the secretary, Steve Mnuchin, shall furnish such committee with any return or return information specified in such request. So there are effectively no conditions. The only condition is that only a few people can do that. Some of those people are Democrats now, and they want to do it. There's no ambiguity there about who can be targeted or how long you can go back or whether it could be being audited. None of that. It's 100% clear. And so Fox News, of course, doesn't even want to bring up whether he's complying with the law or not because they understand how clear it is. Kayleigh is uninterested in it, too. And Donald Trump is going to continue to lie and say that the law is on his side. I only hope that Donald Trump hasn't been so successful in stacking the courts with extreme white right-wingers that they will simply look at this and say, no, it's inconvenient to him. We're worried about what it might reveal, and so I don't care what the law says. I'm going to let him continue to hide it. That is my fear at this point. But on the law, no fear whatsoever. It's as clear as it could possibly be. We're going to take a short break. We come back. The Green New Deal helping already to shape this Democratic primary. We're going to be talking with an activist and organizer around the Green New Deal on how this process is going to continue after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, The host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The past few months have seen a great deal of discussion about the Green New Deal, and it is my hope that it's going to be a big part of this Democratic primary. Joining us now to break down how the Green New Deal goes forward and what effect it might have on choosing our next president, activist and organizer around the Green New Deal, former Bernie Sanders campaign staffer Juliana DeLauro-Velez. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. We're very glad to talk to you, especially about this topic. And so you've been an organizer around this issue. We've had a few months now where it has been a big part of the national conversation in terms of the total amount of policy that's been talked about. What do you think about the path going forward in communicating about the Green New Deal and how that has been done so far? I mean, we had that Senate vote, obviously, an attempt to derail it by Senate Republicans. What do you think so far about the conversation?
Yeah, so I think it's been really telling that every single one of the U.S. presidential candidates for 2020 on the Democratic side voted present for that vote. I think that shows you that they understand how important this issue is and that is actually the path forward. Unfortunately, as we all know, Democrats haven't really been proposing a lot of large-scale solutions to the problems that we're facing today. And the Green New Deal is that moonshot. It is that one thing that we have to do. And it's been, I think it's very telling that all of them have been supporting it, even though they're not 100% sure what it entails. They know that it aspires to actually accomplish the goals that the scientific community is telling us that we have to accomplish in order to avoid this climate catastrophe. And I think that it's actually going to be, the focus of the 2020 Democratic primaries.
I certainly hope that that's the case. So let's talk about some of those Democratic primary contenders, because many, but not all, have actually sponsored the Green New Deal, those who are in elected office right now. And as you said, they basically everyone voted present that was present to vote on that. But in hearing them talk about the Green New Deal, it's not yet a guarantee, from my point of view, that they all mean the same thing when they're talking about it. And so up until very recently, you were working with New Consensus, which was drafting the Green New Deal. From your point of view, what do they need to mean? What needs to be included for it to actually be the Green New Deal and not just them supporting something kind of environmentally progressive but not the Green New Deal?
Yeah, so I think that there are two main pieces to the Green New Deal that we need to be supporting. One of them is policy that's crafted to actually solve the problem. And I know that seems like very common sense that we should be writing policy that actually solves the problem. But unfortunately, that hasn't been the case in the past. We've seen that, you know, a lot of our politicians love to talk about political viability and they draft policy in terms of that. And let's be honest, we know that that means that's a euphemism for can it get support from Republicans? And that's a strategy that's never worked in the past. So one, it needs to actually get us to not have the planet warm past 1.5 degrees Celsius, and it needs to get us to net zero carbon emissions. And two, it needs to have the equity portion of this. It's so disheartening to hear a lot of leaders say that we shouldn't muddy up the planet and something so important like climate change with equity when that is, you know, one of the biggest crises of our time, too. We actually have two existential threats, and one of them is income and wealth inequality. So that's something that also needs to be included. We need protection for workers that are going to lose their jobs once this new green economy is created. We need the creation of, you know, millions of good-paying union jobs. All of those things have to be a part of a Green New Deal in order for it to be the Green New Deal that we want to support.
And so far, of those who are involved in this Democratic primary, or those who are likely to be involved in this Democratic primary, from what you've seen when they've been talking about the Green New Deal, those who might have been involved in the discussions either in Congress or in the Senate, who stands out to you as most, I guess, exemplifying AOC's vision for how the Green New Deal needs to be constituted and how it needs to be passed?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm honestly not sure. I think Senator Sanders has it in him to support a Green New Deal that has all of the equity portions intact. You know, I would hope that Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren and others also follow suit. But to be honest, I'm not sure. As of now, I see that Senator Sanders is the one that can actually support that type of Green New Deal.
Okay. And so we've been talking mainly about the politicians. In terms of public support for the Green New Deal, obviously many people are still learning about it, but we know that at least in early polling, it's quite popular. You've been talking repeatedly about the equity aspect, and pundits, especially in the right wing, often talk about this as what's ridiculous that includes all of these different things. You've laid out sort of pragmatically and philosophically why it needs to include those things. Do you think that that's also important in terms of selling it to the American people, incorporating things like wealth and income inequality, jobs, and all of that?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You know, something that a lot of people, I think, are leaders and currently the people who have power in this country and in this world don't understand is that when you're a working class person, you are not really paying attention to the climate. You know, you do, but you're mainly focused on how are you going to pay your bills? Are you going to get laid off? Are you going to be able to support your family? These are the immediate concerns of the American people, and I think people all over the world. So when you craft legislation of this scope and this magnitude, it includes provisions to support working class people and to incentivize the economy and to create millions of good paying jobs, right? And this is the stuff that, you know, Trump would talk a lot about, like, America needs to keep their labor here and, you know, we need more jobs and we need to make things and we need to incentivize industry. That's exactly what the Green New Deal is hoping to do. And that's what the equity part is hoping to do, to really protect workers and to not only alleviate poverty, but spread wealth and create wealth. That, I mean, we live in a democracy, right? It's a broken democracy, but it's a democracy nonetheless, and people are going to vote for their immediate interests.
I certainly think so. And for that reason, I do hope that it is a big part of this primary discussion going forward. I hope that there are multiple questions during the debates about it. And we want to thank you for joining us, Juliana, both for joining us, but also, you know, Godspeed on organizing around the Green New Deal and making sure that it stays a big part of the public consciousness.
Thank you, John. I hope so, too.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, family accounts of what Fox News has done to people over the course of a few decades. A little bit funny, a little bit dark after this. Throughout my life, I've been pretty lucky that not a lot of people in my family watch Fox News or take it seriously at the very least. But I have known people who have had Fox News run through their family like some sort of digestive tract illness. And I was reading an interesting article where people were sending in accounts of what happened to their family, generally their dads, sometimes moms. It's usually dads, you'll be shocked to find out. After a few years or decades of watching Fox News and the fascinating effect it had on them. And I just want to read a few. This is from an article called, "I Hate What They've Done to Almost Everyone in My Family. Progress is made one funeral at a time," which is just a little bit dark. And I want to read a few of these for you, so buckle up. The first says, "I regret ever showing him Fox News," talking about this person's father. "I turned it on as a teenager and showed it to my parents as a goof. I was laughing at how irresponsible Bill O'Reilly acted on air as an anchor. My mother, a centrist Republican, thought it was funny. My dad started watching regularly. Soon it was the only programming he ingested other than talk radio. He became addicted to the anger. He thought if he was angry at all the injustices Fox News presented to him, he must be righteous. He grew more irritable. He banned watching any news other than Fox News in his presence, and failure to adhere would lead to abusive emotional outbursts. The person goes on to describe how when there would be a power outage or cable would drop, he believed it was the Democrats trying to cut off Fox News. Forgetting, of course, that you also lose access to your microwave, let alone all the other channels on TV. But he apparently really believed that. The next says, I lost an uncle to Fox Brain. He was a middle school teacher in a small upstate New York town, was on the board of the teachers' union, and a big labor guy. After he retired, he started thinking unions were for lazy people and talked a lot about how the government gives free stuff to immigrants who come here illegally. A couple weeks ago, we were talking about my student debt, and he said if I was an illegal, the government would take care of that for me. It effing sucks. The person apparently asked his uncle, so, like, you've seen all the footage where, like, when they come over, we put them in cages, and those cages aren't full of free student loans. And the uncle apparently didn't have a response to that there. But I love this one because it's one thing, many of these have to do with misogyny or racism. And in a lot of cases, it's clear that these people always sort of leaned in that direction. They always had these views. They just sort of became worse over time. But look at this. This is a reversal, a very strong reversal on an issue like labor, like union rights. This person was a union organizer, not just someone who was involved in a union, went to thinking that they're just for lazy people. This person was able to be convinced by watching Fox News, apparently, that all of his experience for literally decades organizing and fighting for workers' rights, that he was representing lazy people, that he himself, I guess, was a lazy person, and eventually, over time, was able to be switched to the opposite position. The next says, I was raised by a strong pro-choice feminist mother who now tells me, quote, cute stories that happen on The Five, the SE Fox daytime show, loves Trump and thinks abortion should be illegal after 6 weeks. Depressing doesn't even cover it. You can't break through that wall of S. And again, imagine, it's one thing to have sort of the worst natural urges of a person be made worse over time. But this is a person who was pro-choice, had a kid, that kid was grown, and then at that point in your life, like think about how hardened your values and your policy preferences are at that point, was able to be switched over to thinking that abortion is fundamentally wrong. And I mean, that's not even, when I think of Fox News, when I think of the issues that they discuss, I wouldn't even necessarily put that on the top five or the top 10, but it was still able to have that strong of an impact. The next says, I think what really did it for me was after Tamir Rice was murdered, I brought it up at breakfast for some insane reason, and my mom said, quote, well, he looked fully adult. Prior to that, she had said stuff like she thought Obama was a Muslim and other racist Fox News parroting, but when she erased the human worth of a child like that, I knew she was truly lost. And that's probably one of those cases we were just talking about where if this person was able to have that position on Tamir Rice, they probably never had the most progressive views on race or anything like that to begin with. But you can fully dehumanize individuals, entire groups over time, and you can get people to either forget or to ignore their fundamental human value. The last says, I hate what they've done to almost everyone in my family. It's absolute poison, and the only thing I think is worse is that there are people who think that destroying the morals and conscience of multiple generations is worth a few more bucks, because I absolutely refuse to believe that people like Hannity don't know what they are doing. I wish I could do something, but who has the time or energy to combat that? And how the hell do you reteach someone to have empathy? And that's perhaps the worst thing. I mean, the thing is, people at the end of the day lead complex lives. Lives are hard. We're surrounded by stress and financial worries and all of that. What we want is to be told that we don't need to bash our brains in over every issue in the country. What we want to do fundamentally is be told that we're right, especially about the things that we think but that bother us. When we start to think, well, am I being selfish? Am I being a little bit biased towards this group? Well, what if you have a TV channel that tells you hour after hour, day after day, week after week, year after year, no, you're actually right. Those people are terrible. Not only are they lazy, but they're robbing good people. They're being paid off by the government. They're taking your money. And you know why it's happening? Because the Democrats want their vote. They're willing to rob you of your hard-earned money to get put into office. And initially, it's a goof. people watch and maybe they laugh a little bit, but eventually they start to hear it over and over again. And how many people have the strength of personality, especially when they might lean a little bit in that direction anyway, to fight against that? And especially when it comes tied in with constant demonization of all other media, the belief that only Fox knows what's going on, everything else is lying to you. And so they build themselves up while breaking down the faith that these people have in any other source of expertise or knowledge, in media or in science, other politicians, anything. Don't trust any of that. Just trust Greg Gutfeld. Seems ridiculous, but eventually they can convince people that it's actually quite reasonable. So look, this article is available at luke.substack.com. There are a lot more. I mean, each one of these goes more in depth. The person who I believe his name is Luke goes into detail about what happened to his own family. And there's a lot of other cases like this as well. It's possible that you have seen this happen in your own life. And look, if you're watching this and you're a right winger and you say that the same thing has happened to your family, but it was like Chris Matthews that did it or something, okay. Post that in the comments. I'll read it. I find it a little bit hard to believe. I don't find them to be particularly persuasive or to have this same sort of hardcore agenda. But I would be interested in reading that as well. So if you have had that experience on either side, feel free to post that or tweet it to me and I will take a look at that. Anyway, with that, we are going to take a break. When we come back, author Nancy Rosenblum is going to join us to talk about the new wave of conspiracy theorists, how they are changing their strategy and convincing people of what they believe and what we might have to do to combat it. After this. So it's clear if you spend any time on the internet that there's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there. But it turns out that they're not all the same, either in their goals or in their techniques. And joining us now to help break it down is author Nancy Rosenblum, author of A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. Nancy, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me, John.
Very glad to have you here. This is a topic I care quite a lot about. And what I find so fascinating about your book is that you talk about how there are conspiracy theorists and there are people who sort of pursue conspiracism that aren't necessarily the same. Can you break down that differentiation?
That's right. But before I answer your question, I have a co-author on this book who I want to acknowledge, Russ Muirhead.
Thank you very much.
We wrote this book together. Yes, well, conspiracy theory in its classic form is a kind of explanation of an event. Mm-hmm. It says that 19 men in a remote corner of Afghanistan could not have brought down the World Trade Center and assaulted the Pentagon, or that a lone gunman could not have killed John F. Kennedy. So that's conspiracy theory, and conspiracy theorists really do a lot of work. They're like scholars. They have dots and patterns and evidence and argument. And sometimes these conspiracy theories are true, sometimes they're not, sometimes the evidence is warranted, sometimes it's not. But in any case, a conspiracy theory really is an attempt to persuade people that the unintelligible is intelligible and the unbelievable is believable by giving them reasoning that we can understand, whether we accept it or not. What we have today is the decoupling of conspiracy and theory. We have conspiracy without the theory. We have sheer assertion by President Trump. Obama tapped my phones in Trump Tower, or the election was rigged. I really won the popular vote, except that Hillary Clinton managed to bus 3 million illegal voters to the polls. Or Pizzagate, mm-hmm. which is the most fantastic of all. And the point is that there are no dots, there are no patterns. There's bare assertion, or there's innuendo, or I'm just asking questions. And this kind of conspiracism has consequences that the classic conspiracism, I think, conspiracy theory does not.
Well, then that begs the follow-up. What are the consequences that are different in the case of this new sort of wave of conspiracism?
Because what's being called for is not a belief in an argument. What's being called for is repetition and assent. And what makes this new conspiracism true enough is that a lot of people are saying it. That's Trump's mantra. Asked whether, for example, George Soros is bribing people to come across the southern border, Trump will say, it's true enough. A lot of people are saying it. And what that indicates is that what you're looking for is a kind of assent or repetition that's really political participation and political identification. And its consequences for us, I think, are as a nation and as public discourse are really significant because, for one thing, it's very disorienting. That is, they have changed the notion of what it means to know something from any kind of evidence or argument and reason to a kind of assertion and assent that's tribalistic. I think that's the main way of putting it. And if I can read you something. I want to read them so I get it clear, make sure that it's correct, about what true enough sounds like. When a Republican congressman was asked about the allegation that the Democratic Party had conspired to create a clash between white nationalists and protesters in Charlottesville, he says, "I'm not saying it's true, but I'm saying it's completely plausible." Mm. Or where Trump's press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, was asked about the fact that Trump had tweeted a video that falsely showed a Muslim migrant committing an assault. She said, "Whether it's a real video, the threat is real." And so, this is the significance. It's not about warranted or unwarranted evidence and patterns and reasoning. It's about participation and assent.
Oh, in a lot of cases, the examples you're giving are either politicians or people who are representatives or spokespeople for the politicians. Generally, I would prefer if those weren't the sorts of people who are pursuing conspiracy theories or something like them. But in the past, you'd also have people in sort of alternative media, regular people who believe these things. Is this a case where this new wave is generally relegated to people in positions of authority? Or do you see that same sort of stance by, for instance, maybe the followers of a particular politician, their willingness to believe what would a thing that would require a conspiracy, but to not actually have any interest in uncovering it or doing the work of actually investigating it?
Right. I think you're right that the cast of characters is a large cast of characters. It's not just Trump or political officials, although those are the significant actors, because if it were just people on the internet or even conspiracy entrepreneurs on radio, I would not be hitting the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the conspiracism that I'm describing is carried out by Fox News and other cable channels and so on. So it's reaching vast numbers of people. And the significance of the fact that political representatives don't stand up and speak truth to conspiracy is enormous. It means that the consequences of this kind of conspiracism, which is to delegitimate institutions of all kinds, both regular party rivalry and also knowledge-producing institutions and so on, goes unchecked.
So what you've described, how does this change what we need to do or should do in responding to this sort of behavior?
I don't know that it changes it. It does raise the question whether, that old slogan that the answer is always more speech, whether that's a functional answer anymore. I think it's morally required, and it may be, in some cases, persuasive to people who are agnostic about all of this. You're never going to persuade a conspiracist of the fact that that what they're saying has no basis in reality, is a compromised account of reality. So there is always speaking truth to conspiracy, and I think that the most important people to do that really are, in this age of politics and Trump, political representatives. Those are the people who are, closely connected to these partisans, and it is a partisan event going on here. It's the conservative Republicans who are creating and propagating this kind of conspiracy. The leftists, while they may have conspiracists, they're old-fashioned conspiracy theorists, right? They collect evidence. they make arguments. They're Rachel Maddow trying to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's the conservative Republicans that are this new form of conspiracism, which is bare assertion and just looking for assent and repetition. So I think speaking truth is one thing, but it has to be done by the people who are persuasive, which are people of your political party, political representatives. And then I think there's sort of what we call enacting democracy. That is, when institutions are attacked, sometimes the people in those institutions will stand up and explain why it is they're going through the processes that they're going through and the significance of it. When Trump, for example, who believes that elections are rigged, set up his Election Integrity Commission, do you remember that? Mm-hmm. Which was out to collect information from all the secretaries of state of all the states on voters in order to prove how many voters were fraudulent. Many, many states actually refused to participate. Mm. They said that this was a witch hunt against fraudulent voters who didn't really exist in great numbers, and they weren't going to participate in this sort of fraudulent creation of a suspect institution.
Well, Nancy Rosenblum, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Your book is A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy, which you co-wrote with Russell Muirhead. And so thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, meanwhile, in news from around the world after this. And now it's time for news from around the world in a segment we call Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in Brunei, they took a big step back on LGBTQ rights. Last week, Brunei, a tiny tropical nation on the island of Borneo, a former British protectorate that is home to 420,000 people, introduced harsh new Sharia laws, including death by stoning for adultery and gay sex, and amputation of limbs for theft. Since that came out less than a week ago, many reporters have been sent to Brunei to find out, sort of get the temperature of the country, see how people feel, especially those in communities that might be targeted under these new laws. And apparently on the ground, young Bruneians say they are less scared of being prosecuted under the new laws than of how they might embolden religious conservatives and justify acts of hate against them, like strangers trying to run them over in the street, or worse. Although I'm sure they're also quite scared of the possible court verdicts against them as well. But the thing is, like, how can you expect that there will not be an increase in hate crimes when you have told people who have hatred for this community that the government agrees with you? And given the opportunity, they will take these people's lives as well. And so this was obviously a very scary time to be a part of the LGBTQ community and live in Brunei. And so my heart definitely goes out to them. Meanwhile, in... Meanwhile, in the Arctic, a new study reveals that things are really heating up. In a bad way, though, not in a funny way. According to the study, the Arctic has gotten warmer by 3.1 degrees Celsius in the cold season, or what used to be the cold season, from October to May, and greener and wetter. It enjoys less snow cover, contains less land and sea ice, and is subject to greater variations in temperatures and extreme weather events. Air temperature, land ice thickness, permafrost temperature, precipitation, terrestrial snow cover, sea ice thickness, and tundra greening are among the indicators studied. And this is actually a study going back quite some time. And I know that there will be the skeptics who will say, no, but I found one time where supposedly there was slightly more ice briefly in one spot. Well, this is going back literally decades, and it's looking at a number of different ways of analyzing the overall impact of climate change during our lifetime or on the Arctic. And on all of these, they have found strong evidence that things are for worse, not just in overall temperature, but like we said, the permafrost is melting. There's more greenery when there's not supposed to be, by the way. We showed you that picture in the beginning, showing the polar bears and everything. That is already outdated. Those polar bears died. No, but it is actually really bad for them. And so we cover this every once in a while just to remind people this is a serious thing, and we really hope that the popular consensus would catch up with the scientific consensus on an issue as important as this. Meanwhile, in... Wow, that is a beautiful shot of Saudi Arabia there. Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia, we got some pretend consequences for the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. The U.S. State Department on Monday publicly designated 16 people for their roles in the killing of writer Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last October. Such designation makes those individuals and immediate family members ineligible for entry into the United States. That list of 16 includes Saud al-Qahtani, a former aide to the Crown Prince, and Maher Mutreb, who was part of the Crown Prince's entourage on trips abroad. It also includes 14 other people, and I looked at the list. It took a while. Mohammed bin Salman is not one of them, even though we all know at this point that this mission would have never gone off if he had not given his okay on it. And so he's still free to visit. He can come and he can do his little pro-business development trips. He can be interviewed by people. He can meet with Donald Trump, whatever. Some of his lower-level lieutenants have been scapegoated on this, but he will be just fine. And that's what we've gotten after more than 6 months of waiting for consequences. Meanwhile, in... Meanwhile, in South Africa, a poacher was killed, and I don't know exactly how to feel about it. A suspected rhino poacher in South Africa's Kruger National Park was killed by an elephant last week. Lions then scavenged the poacher's remains. In the end, they found only his skull and a pair of pants, which is really rough. And look, I know, look, poaching is terrible, and poachers are terrible, and they do terrible things. And I know that everybody's been dunking on this dead guy since this news came out, but I guess I'm just too much of a progressive. I still don't want people to be killed, whether by some sort of epic team-up of rhinos, elephants, and lions. We got to stop poaching. I don't want people to be eaten, necessarily. And so, again, just a little bit conflicted on this, but feel free to let me know how you feel in the comment section down below. By the way, thank you to everybody who's been watching the show, for joining us, for doing the new reviews. There's been a lot of them. We will be reading some of them soon. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, so we will see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, Johnny Derola. I'll see you soon.